You're listening to EPN, the ePodcast Network.
This is Enterprise Radio and your host, Eric Dye.
This is Eric Dye, and once again, welcome to Enterprise Radio, your EPN channel for exclusive interviews with entrepreneurs, authors, small business owners, and top executives who have experienced great success, as well as the sharing of their latest creations, products, and or services that can help you build your business, leading to business success. Today, we are with Neil Thornberry, founder and CEO of MStrat LLC, who is a noted author, consultant, speaker, and subject matter expert. Expert in the field of applied innovation. His new book is Innovation Judo, Disarming Roadblocks and Blockheads on the Path to Creativity. Neil, certainly love that title, and welcome to Enterprise Radio.
Well, thank you very much, Eric. I'm happy to be here.
And we're certainly happy that you came out this morning. So at the heart of your book, Innovation Judo, is the notion that most organizations are simply not logical when it comes to innovation, and there are numerous factors that prevent innovators from bringing their ideas to fruition. What are some of those factors, and how do they get in the way?
Yeah, well, that's correct. And I don't, by the way, I don't intimate that these companies are particularly purposely like this, but I think they default into it. And I can explain how that happens and why it happens, and I'll talk about some of the factors. Perhaps one, I'll give you a couple of examples, because examples often lead to telling the story. So there's a fellow named James McInerney, who was a former General Electric executive, and he was one of the people who was looked at to perhaps replace Jack Welch. He was hired by 3M Corporation, which is considered by many the icon of innovation in industry. You know, the sticky notes, the post-it notes, they've had DNA of innovation for years and years and years. But they had a little bit of slowing down, they had some wasted costs and so on, so they hired McInerney from GE. And he brought in Lean Six Sigma, which probably many of your listeners know is the ultimate in quality control. They, you know, have black belts and green belts all trying to take costs out of the system and take, you know, errors out of the system to make a perfect product. They brought him into the head up of 3M, and their innovation quotient went right downhill. And even though their stock went up, so McInerney, you know, employed Lean Six Sigma, cut a lot of costs. He cut 8,000 people. But they lost their innovation sort of spark. And part of the reason is he tried to apply in a logical fashion. He tried to logically apply a Lean Six Sigma approach to the company, but he also did that to R&D and the innovation people. So you can imagine if you're an engineer, an innovator, and somebody comes in and says, by the way, we want you to have an errorless innovation process. You can imagine how well that went down. All of us in innovation know you have to make mistakes or you don't innovate. In fact, it's impossible not to make mistakes if you're innovating. You try something, it doesn't work. You try something else, it doesn't work, etc. And so for several years, the innovation capability of 3M actually got lost under a very logical, process-oriented, you know, very popular approach. And in fact, Art Fry, who invented the post-it notes that you and I are all familiar with, claimed that if he were in 3M under this, the post-it notes would never have seen the light of day, because they were forced into looking at small incremental innovations, not the breakthrough that Post-it Notes was. And they took away 3M's sort of time to play. So I see factors that inhibit, even though it's not purposely illogical, it winds up being illogical, sort of falling into different categories. Obviously, people can be illogical. In the book, I talk about a CEO who said to his folks, I want more risk-taking. And then he simultaneously shot the first person who made a mistake that took a risk. So you can see people tend to do that. But in my last example, it's sort of the organization design and the CEO's values that seemed logical but actually hurt innovation. So those are a couple of examples. I can give you more, but you see a lot of that in organizations that think they're doing the right thing. And because of our ability to implement cost controls and technology, we often suffocate innovation, but unintentionally. But it becomes illogical.
Now, innovation judo sounds like you need to be prepared to fight for your ideas. Is that the reference that you're making here, or what's the significance of judo in your book's title?
Yeah, so judo is an interesting metaphor, and I took judo for many years when I was a young man and even in adult life. And I like this sport because it was teaching you the art of self-defense, but you never, ever permanently damaged an opponent. So judo's called the gentle way. It's meant to disable temporarily an opponent by taking their balance away, you know, throwing them over your hip. And you may stun somebody, but you never actually permanently hurt them like karate would do or some other martial art that's meant to cause permanent damage. So the last thing I wanted to do was to tell innovators that they should do permanent damage to their organization. But I did find a lot of them complaining to me and feeling very frustrated that they couldn't get things done in their organization because of the roadblocks and blockheads, as I refer to in the book. And so I started to realize that some of the successful ones, I profile four of these people in the book, used this set of skills that I could only describe well as judo. They temporarily disabled the opponent just long enough to get something through. And that, of course, led to my thinking about what this metaphor could do if you could turn around and make it prescriptive rather than just descriptive. So I use judo because it's meant to disable temporarily but never purposely harm somebody. I was in the book, I tell a story about being in college shortly after I started taking my judo course. And I went to a fraternity house to meet some of my friends, and I had never pledged for this fraternity. So one of the brothers started to tell me I didn't belong, and sort of playfully but not so playfully said I had to leave. So he started to push me out the door. And I've been taking the judo class for about a month now or 2 months, so I had a couple moves in me. So I knew if I pushed him back, he'd push me harder. So I shoved him back, and he came charging at me. I turned my hips and put my finger around his belt, put my hips under his, and did what's called a hip throw. And he went head over heels and landed on the middle of the floor in the frat house. He was not hurt, but he was certainly stunned, and he never pushed me again. But it's an apt analogy. I just temporarily disabled him. So what I try to teach the innovation people who are struggling, this is not meant for people who work in an organization that's got the DNA and they have a nice pathway to innovation that you can follow. This is for people that have a great idea, they're encouraged to innovate, and then all of a sudden they run into these roadblocks or blockheads. And that's when I think they should deploy some of these judo skills to temporarily get these blockheads and roadblocks out of the way, or at least neutralized temporarily, so they can get their idea a chance to live.
Great explanation there. And what should small business owners know about the innovation process, and how does it differ from the inside big companies?
Yeah, so they all face a similar problem. And I work, you know, with established companies and large companies and some small companies as well. There's one thing they all have to understand, and then I'll try to differentiate sort of what I think the big companies versus the smaller companies need to pay attention to. In my travels around organizations who ask me to come in and talk about innovation to help them improve their ability to innovate, I start with the first question I always ask, and it's in the book. I call them the seven I's of innovation, the seven I's of innovation. It's a model that I developed. The first question I always ask is, what's the intent of innovation? And I ask that question because so many people unfortunately misuse that term. And they say, we need to be more innovative. You know, we need a more innovative culture. And I always come back to them and say, so if you had a more innovative culture, what's the output you would like? So I try to describe to them that they should not talk about innovation as a destination. That's sort of what we've gotten into. We need to innovate. So I work a lot with the Navy. I'm the director of initiatives, innovation initiatives at the Center for Executive Education at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, where I do part-time work. And I always ask them, what's the intent? It's not a destination. Talking about innovation as a destination, it leads you down a false path. So I always say, well, so what's the intent? So both large and small companies need to say, I see innovation as a set of tools that should do something for me. This is where creative thinking, innovative thinking can lead to something. If you don't understand intent, then you're sort of like Alice in Wonderland. You're at the fork in the road, and you say to the Cheshire Cat, I'm lost. And the cat says, which road do you want to take? And you say, I don't know. And then he said, either one will do. So intent is primary. So both large and small companies need to follow these seven I's, and I won't go into detail, but basically you do it. What are we doing innovation for? What's the purpose? New product, new process? Do we really want a new culture? What's the intent of the toolkit? Then we have to build an organizational infrastructure that supports that. Then we have to investigate whatever problem we're trying to do, whether it's new product or new process, and only then do we get to ideation. Unfortunately, a lot of companies jump into ideation first without going through the intent question. And then I talk about, in the book again, identification is next, infection of the idea with others, and finally implementation. So I think both large and small companies need to pay attention to that innovation process the seven I's refer to, because they often jump directly to ideation, which is the fun part, but then they wind up going backwards and saying, geez, we didn't get it. And an example of that, I sat in on a government group, one of the large government groups that asked me to come in and speak, and we spent about a half an hour talking about innovation. I said, well, what's the purpose of innovating? Why are you doing it? And they said, well, because we need new ideas. I said, about what? And they said, well, about innovation. I said, innovation for what? And then pretty soon we went around the circle about three times, and they admitted they actually didn't know why they were innovating. So both large and small companies need that. The difference I see is that large companies need to deconstruct the barriers that inhibit innovation. And that's usually because over years, just like a computer, organizations tend to fragment. And just like computers leave fragments behind from programs you've run, organizations leave fragments of old institutions and cultures behind when new people come on board. They usually don't dismantle what was before, or they dismantle only part of it and leave fragments. So we wind up with silly things that we have to deal with that get in the way. This is the stuff I talk about that's sort of the roadblocks. Small companies actually need more help in building some of that infrastructure, but they have to be very careful that they don't overbuild and start organizing to the point where they suffocate innovation. I believe small companies, it's easier to put the brakes on building that stuff over time. It's much harder for large companies to deconstruct that stuff, and that's why I think innovation judo is a very important skill set, because organizations aren't very good at reducing that kind of stuff. The other big difference is, and this is really a critical one for innovation, small companies tend not to be so siloed. If you and I were working in the same company and we needed to talk to each other, I'd call down the hall, or you're sitting next to me and we can talk about interesting ideas. And we know that innovation is sparked by the collision of ideas. So diversity is extremely important for innovation. You talk, I talk, I'm from marketing, you're from sales, and we sit around and pretty soon we come up with a really interesting idea to affect the customer. That's not so hard to do in small companies. When you get larger, they develop silos. And then the ability to cross-talk becomes less and less. And I can show you case after case and also research that demonstrates that the more siloed an organization is, where people live in their own little functions, like the marketers only spend time with themselves and they don't really cross over the organization, their innovation quotient goes way down. So small companies have a much easier time of doing that. Large companies have to work hard to overcome that. In fact, Procter & Gamble had to create a whole extra group of people that literally crossed over the boundaries. They call them boundary spanners, because nobody was crossing over the chasms of the silos, so they had to create a group that actually went across the silos and pulled ideas out of those silos so that they could work on them as a company. I think that's really critical. In the book, I talk about Jim Rep, who's one of my judo heroes who works for Jeep. And Jim was the first to create a mass-produced Jeep Wrangler called the Rubicon. It's considered probably the best mass-produced off-roader in the world. He worked in engineering. He was a Jeep nut, as he calls himself, on the lunatic fringe of Jeep people. He'd go off trails, climb rocks, and, you know, the more dense you had in your Jeep, the better it was. It was a badge of honor. So he went to marketing and said, boy, there's a market out there for all the people I know with these off trails. They want a mass-produced Jeep because they're all putting $10,000 to $15,000 of their own money to upgrade their Jeeps to do all this hill climbing. Of course, he talked to the marketing people and said, you're an engineer, go back to work. We understand the market. There's no market. Anyway, in the book, I tell the story of how he eventually got a couple of executives trapped in the Rubicon Trail in California where they practiced these Jeeps, and he had built a secret Jeep inside his garage. It was all upgraded like the current Rubicon is today, but it didn't look any different on the outside. And he was able to beat every other Jeep in the stock from Chrysler, and nobody knew why that one Jeep did so better than the other ones, or so much better. So finally he revealed to the executives that this is the kind of Jeep he built and that there was a market, because all the people who were consumers stood around it trying to figure out how he could get one. If he just listened to marketing, or the corporation just listened to marketing, this successful Jeep would not have arrived on the scene. And so he used judo skills to make that happen. But the silos between marketing and engineering were so severe that they missed a huge opportunity. Marketing said that Jeep would sell about three of the units in a year, and they sold about 15,000 in the first year of its entry into the market. So there's a good example of why, you know, large companies have a lot tougher time with the silos versus smaller companies. The innovation cycle is the same, but the context is very different. In the book, I talk about the intersection between two very important variables. One's called wackiness. That's the illogic. That's the sort of the politics, the nutty stuff about, you know, things that don't quite fit, Lean Six Sigma, trying to innovate or you know, take a risk but don't make a mistake kind of stuff, versus the intersection of complexity. The more complex your organization is and the more wacky it is, the harder it is to innovate. So smaller companies have usually less complexity and therefore less difficulty finding the way to the door of innovation, and they also tend to have less wackiness. That's a long explanation for the differences, but I think the cycle is the same. I just think the context is very different, and therefore the leadership and management practices to support innovation become very different as well.
Lastly, you write in your book, since entrepreneurship always involves innovation, they are by definition innovators as well as entrepreneurs. Can you explain how so?
Yes, and so let me differentiate just a second the type of entrepreneurship I'm talking about. I spent a lot of my life as a professor at Babson College, which is considered like the number one school in entrepreneurship, in the world in some respects, but it's a very specialized niche school. And so I taught a lot of entrepreneurs and helped entrepreneurs develop their businesses and so forth. And we differentiate two types. One's lifestyle entrepreneur. That's where you and I decide we don't want a boss and we decide to open up a McDonald's franchise or open up a small printing store. And I'm not talking about those entrepreneurs that are simply lifestyle. I'm talking about more infrastructure-induced entrepreneurship where the startup company tries to, you know, utilize banking and commerce and transportation infrastructure, not only start a business, but grow it to large size. So let me use the term infrastructure-induced versus buying a franchise for McDonald's, which I think is different. In infrastructure-induced entrepreneurship, almost always to get into the market, to make an edge for yourself so you can actually grow your business, you got to take a different angle than everybody else. So whether it's Michael Dell starting a business, realizing that he couldn't compete in computers, but he sure could change the value proposition in terms of custom made, but more importantly, he gets the money up front. I mean, that's innovative. It's not about the computers. It's about how he delivers it to the organization. And so I think that entrepreneurs in general have to be innovative in order to find the angle that allows them to survive against competition or to create new niches or new markets. So almost all the entrepreneurs I know that are infrastructure-type entrepreneurs trying to build, you know, significant businesses always have something new that they're trying to institute, or they do it better than somebody else. So they're always innovating in some way. And, of course, they're entrepreneurs, so they're trying to turn that innovation into value creation. At the end of the day, all the innovation in the world without value creation is fun but folly. So I see entrepreneurs as those that are successful ones have the package of innovation. They're always dealing with something new or some angle or some different approach to the customer, or they don't get noticed. But they also combine that with trying to turn that into some kind of value creation for stockholders, customers, etc. I know a lot of innovators that are very good at ideation, and they're very good at coming up with ideas, but they don't have one of the seven judo skills, which is discipline, which allows them to take an idea, assess it for opportunity characteristics, which are different than ideas. Ideas are a dime a dozen, opportunities are rare. And then use that assessment of opportunity characteristics to then build a business around. So that's why I comment and make the comment, and a good example of this is I used to do a lot of work for Siemens Corporation worldwide. They're 450,000 people, and they compete with General Electric in a number of markets, and they used to tell me that they were smarter than General Electric. And I said, so how do you know you're smarter? And they said, we have more patents. And I believe that's true. I believe if you did a count, you'd find that they have many more patents than General Electric. And so they use that as their metric for intellectual capital and therefore innovation. Then I ask them who made more money on, you know, return on capital, et cetera. Well, it turns out General Electric does. So it's a good example of lots of innovation at Siemens, but those didn't turn into value creation. Whereas General Electric may have less in terms of, intellectual capital or, you know, these kind of things. But what they do have, they're very good at turning those into profit-making ventures. So that's why I say, innovation and entrepreneurship are siblings. They're very close siblings. But a lot of innovators don't understand the discipline of the entrepreneurial side. So I actually try to teach them how to think as entrepreneurs, not just as innovators. Otherwise, they start to they miss the concept of turning an idea into some kind of value creation for somebody. Entrepreneurs know if, you know, don't create value for somebody, it doesn't sell. Nobody's going to buy it. Whereas innovators oftentimes think of the great idea and it's wonderful, but they don't understand that it has to create value. But about 4 years ago, I was asked by New York Times to look at a young lady who was starting an internet business. It was basically t-shirt wear or garments for women who were pregnant. So, you know, how can you create these sort of nice t-shirts and so on? And they asked me to look at her plan and then predict how well she would do in the next year. And then they interviewed me a year later to see if my predictions were accurate. And I said, and it turned out, I don't think she's going to do well. I think she's going to fail. And unfortunately, it turned out that she did fail. Part of the reason was she had the innovation hat on, but she didn't understand the entrepreneurial piece. Even though she had a marketing background, she was too enthusiastic about her idea. And you got to have passion or you never get off the ground. But she didn't marry it with one of the skills I talk about, which is the discipline of saying, okay, I got a great idea. Now I have to test that to see if it has opportunity characteristics, and there are five of those. And if it doesn't have opportunity characteristics, then I need to reshape it so that it now tends to look more like an opportunity than an idea. So like many, you know, entrepreneurs that fail, she ran headlong into the internet market, which she'd never been in, with this great idea, but little understanding of whether the idea was an opportunity or not. So they said, well, you know, are you pleased with your prediction? I said, of course I'm not pleased with it because she didn't do well. But I said she also just got one of the best tuitions she could have gotten without having to go to MBA school. Because then she learned, you know, the failure teaches you a lot if you pay attention. And I think she went back out, and I think she's doing better now. But it's a good example of the difference between innovation and entrepreneurship. And in my classes, I always try to teach them to put on an entrepreneurial hat in addition to their innovation garments, because otherwise one without the other tends to be a little bit fun but folly. Entrepreneurs tend to wear them both, at least in the infrastructure-induced ventures that I talk about. There may be exceptions, but most of the people I talk about, they're pretty innovative to be successful entrepreneurs.
Well, this certainly has been insightful, and I can't thank you enough for taking the time to be with us here this morning. If you would, before you go, tell our listeners where they can get more information about MStrat online and where our listeners can pick up your book, Innovation Judo, Disarming Roadblocks and Blockheads on the Path to Creativity.
Absolutely. I'm happy to. So my website for our business, which is actually an innovation consulting and enabling business, is called MStrat. That's I as in Indigo, M as in Mary, and then Strat for strategy. www.mstrat.net. And you'll see a link to the book, but you can easily go on Amazon.com and get the book. In fact, it's exclusively sold there because if you are inventive and sort of innovative, you know that that's one of the fastest growing places to distribute a book. And so it's easy to get on Amazon.com. It just came out last month. And hopefully it'll be helpful to people who are, there are two audiences for it. One's the actual innovator, actually three actually. One's the innovator, one's the leader of innovation, because sometimes they're not the same. And then I have a couple chapters on the book for senior managers to say, how do you counterbalance this inertia that often happens, this bureaucracy that often happens with innovation? Because it's very hard to turn an on and off switch for innovation, but you can counterbalance organizations that have a lot of innovation killers without necessarily changing the whole culture. So anyway, I hope it's I give a lot of stories. One's about a Navy SEAL. One's about the Jim Rep, the guy who invented the Rubicon against all odds, etc. So hopefully you'll find both some knowledge and inspiration in the book. And you can look at our site to see what kind of things we do. And thanks very much for the chance to come on.
You betcha, Neil. Thanks for joining us here on Enterprise Radio.
My pleasure.
We've been speaking with Neil Thornberry, founder and CEO of MStrat LLC, who is a noted author, consultant, speaker, and subject matter expert in the field of applied innovation. He is also the author of the new book, Innovation Judo, Disarming Roadblocks and Blockheads on the Path to Creativity. And the website of reference, once again, is mstrat.net. And this is Eric Dye, and you've been listening to Enterprise Radio, a part of EPN, the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. Pick up our iPhone or Android mobile app for your mobile listening convenience. And once again, we do thank you for tuning in.
Thanks for listening to Enterprise Radio here on EPN. For more information or to subscribe to this podcast, visit epodcastnetwork.com.
This is the ePodcast Network.